I'm Jen White. This is 1A. The United States is facing two crises, COVID-19 and racial injustice. More and more people are saying that both have been exacerbated by the Trump presidency. His handling of the coronavirus has caused many to question his decision-making abilities and his motivations. An AP poll from late July shows just 32% of Americans support his strategy. And his accusatory rhetoric about protests in response to the killing of George Floyd has fed into racial tensions that have always been just below the surface. The Atlantic tackles both of these matters in its September issue called How Did It Come to This? Joining me now are the authors of the issue's two cover stories. Ed Yong is a science writer for The Atlantic. Ed, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And Ibram Kendi is a number one New York Times bestselling author and the director of the Boston University Center for Anti-Racist Research. Ibram, welcome to 1A.
Hello, how are you?
Doing well. So, Ed, your report in The Atlantic is called Anatomy of an American Failure, and it serves as an autopsy of sorts for America's handling of the pandemic. Of all the missteps you uncovered, where do you think the biggest failure is?
I don't think I want to name any particular one, but the problem is that there were so many. So while other countries successfully controlled the virus because they did enough things, America floundered because it failed in so many different respects. And that's the most important message from this story, that we had a strained healthcare system that relies on this bizarre system of employer-tied insurance, that we underfunded public health, that we elected leaders who disregard expertise and evidence and who lie and misinform, that we have social media platforms that spread misinformation faster than genuine information. I really could go on, but from prisons to nursing homes to the rest of our buildings to all the aspects of our lives, the country had over time accumulated so many vulnerabilities that this virus exploited and tore open. And if we want to do better in the future for pandemics that we know are going to come, we have to avoid this temptation to go back to normal, because normal led to this.
You don't shy away from your criticism of the president in your piece, and objectivity in journalism is something we've covered extensively on this show. We talked about it earlier this week. Did you struggle to, I don't want to say remain neutral, because that's not exactly the right term, but balancing out incompetence versus intent in this piece?
Yeah, I think that's a really important distinction to make. I think what matters to me is to be honest and to be fair. And I think it is absolutely clear that the president has numerous failings which have cost America as a whole dearly during this crisis. And we should not be shy about talking about that. We should not be shy about discussing his lack of empathy, his narcissism, his egotism, his racism and xenophobia, the fact that he lies constantly. These are terms we are fair to use because they are true. I think it's important to recognize that Trump is central to this problem, but not the only thing that matters. And even if we elect another leader, we need to hold them to the same level of accountability. As I said, we can't just go back to normal.
Ibram, in your cover story, The End of Denial, you cite recent polling from Monmouth that shows more Americans are becoming aware of the racism that exists in this country. And for people of color, you know, it's been impossible to deny the existence of racism. But for white people, they're seeing it more now, according to polling. What do you think shifted?
I think there were, of course, many factors, but I think the central factor was the political career of Donald Trump. And when you look at the polling, you see that, indeed, according to the polling, many Americans believed during the Obama era that this nation was post-racial, that racism wasn't a big problem. And it really wasn't until Trump arrived on the political scene by launching, of course, his campaign, by condemning Latinx immigrants, and by imagining that he was going to ban people of Muslim faith, and ultimately saying black people lived in hell, that you saw these massive shifts begin to take course. And there was actually more of a shift and Americans saying that racism is a big problem from 2015 to 2016, then from 2016 to 2020. And so, like, his arrival, right, on that political scene during that critical period from 2015 to 2016, and then his presidency of racist policies and ideas, but even more importantly, of denying that those ideas and policies were racist, really put up a mirror that indeed the heartbeat of racism is denial.
And how dramatic of a shift are we seeing?
Well, by June of this year, according to one poll, about 3 out of 4 Americans were saying racial and ethnic discrimination was a big problem. And you compare that to 2015, it was only about half. You compare that to the middle of the Obama era, it seemed to be about a third. And so you're seeing this massive shift in public opinion about racism being a problem.
You always make it a point to distinguish between not being racist and being anti-racist. Explain what the difference is.
Well, as people, I think, have come to learn through the Trump presidency, typically people say, I'm not racist, or they say even in a more extreme sense that I'm the least racist person anywhere in the world, or I'm the least racist person you've ever interviewed, or I'm the least racist person you've ever encountered, typically in response to engaging in racism and being asked by a reporter or being challenged for their racism. And so the typical response is, I'm not racist. And indeed, slaveholders claimed they were not racist. Jim Crow segregationists stated that it was perfectly separate but equal down here. And so there's a long history of racists denying their own racism by saying, I'm not racist. While to be anti-racist is clearly to be challenging racism itself as opposed to denying it.
We're speaking with Ibram Kendi of the Boston University Center for Anti-Racist Research and Ed Yong of The Atlantic. They've written pieces for The Atlantic's September issue about the underlying issue of racism in President Trump's handling of the COVID-19 pandemic. Ed, I want to circle back to something you said about President Trump. And it's important to note that the president, any president, is not all powerful. They have to act within the limitations of the Constitution. They consult with their advisors and cabinet. How much responsibility should be placed on those around President Trump who have enabled his rhetoric and policies?
Yeah, I think that it's some, for sure. It's not just him. It's not just one person at the top. But he has also filled his administration with people who are like-minded, who share the same problematic values, and who also have discounted expertise and evidence at a point when the nation needs it the most. This is as much a referendum on Trumpism as it is on Trump. And I think it should be a referendum on the values and the events that led to the election of such a person. I wrote a piece in 2016 between the election and the inauguration about how Trump would handle a pandemic. And that piece suggested that he would use ineffectual travel bans, he would tweet rashly, he would legitimize conspiracy theories and misinformation, and that he would just mishandle the crisis. And that is exactly what has happened. I don't claim any sort of special insight here. My point is more that the failings of this president and this administration were utterly evident before the presidency actually began. Like, Trump has always told us who he is. And I think we need to think hard about what kind of leaders we want going forward. Like, this pandemic feels like an epochal, generation-defining event. But this is not the only pandemic the rest of us, hopefully, like, if we make it through this, this is not the last pandemic we're going to experience. This is not the worst pandemic that could happen. So look at how badly our institutions have fared under the leadership of someone who has repeatedly corrupted those same institutions. The CDC, the greatest public health agency in the world, has been sidelined in the middle of the worst pandemic for generations. How could that possibly have happened? It shows the influence of the person at the top on everything else.
Ibram, your thoughts about the role of the people around President Trump?
So, I mean, I just agree with what Ed stated. But I would also sort of add, at least specifically as it relates to racist policies, he certainly has used his executive power to issue racist policies, to even pardon people who practiced or racially profiled people. He's also, but then again, he has been in close collaboration with a Senate Majority Leader in Mitch McConnell, who has refused to basically call for a vote on policies that have been passed by the House that could essentially make voting easier. If it wasn't for the U.S. Senate, he would certainly may not even still be president right now. And so I think the story of the Trump presidency in its totality will certainly include the Republican Senate, will currently include Mitch McConnell. But when it comes to the coronavirus, I believe, as Ed stated, when it comes to Americans finally coming to grips with how pervasive racism and its denial is, I think Trump is a singular subject.
Ed, you said that COVID is, in the piece you read as well, is merely a harbinger of worse plagues to come. When you think about the U.S. response to this pandemic, how do you look ahead to the next one with any hope that it'll be handled differently, more effectively?
It's okay. So I'll give you the pessimistic and optimistic versions. The pessimistic version goes like this: historically, the U.S. and in fact every other country has always gone through these panic and neglect cycles where an epidemic hits. Everyone freaks out and a lot of attention and resources flow to the problem. The country becomes briefly more resilient and then everything dissipates immediately as soon as we enter peacetime again. And we are seeing that. We have already seen that. The pandemic isn't even over and people have already lapsed into the neglect phase of this cycle, which is truly galling to witness in real time. The optimistic version I'll offer is ties into what Ibram has been talking about. The Black Lives Matter protests in the wake of the deaths of the killings of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and others are a sign, I think, that America is willing to look at systemic problems in a very different way than it has in the past. And I think it's accumulation of all that we've seen during this pandemic. I think people have looked at this country that is supposedly powerful, exceptional, rich, and seen one by one, institution after institution fail. The healthcare system, the public health system, and the carceral system, the president, the highest levels of government. It's all come apart. And on top of that, we see the disproportionate burden that COVID-19 has exacted upon Black and brown and poor communities. We've seen who actually counts as an essential worker. And I think because of all of that, people have been more willing to say, what institutions are failing us? And in particular, whom are they failing? And I think you can draw a direct line between that and the intensity of the recent protests and how opinion on race has shifted, not just in the lead up to this, as Ibram said, but you know, also just during it. The support that Black Lives Matter has had in just the recent months alone, the rise in that support is astonishing. And I think that these things are all interrelated. And if we can hold on to that, if we can maintain our sense that this is the moment for radical systemic change, then maybe we will do better in the plagues to come.
Well, a recent interview with President Trump and Jonathan Swan of Axios has been getting a lot of attention this week. And here's a bit of the president discussing the coronavirus death rates.
We're going to look.
Let's look.
And if you look at death,
yeah,
there,
it started to go up again.
One. Well, right here, the United States is lowest in numerous categories. We're lower than the world.
Lower than
the
world?
Lower than Europe.
In what? In what?
Take a look. Right here. Here's case death.
Oh, you're doing death as a proportion of cases. I'm talking about death as a proportion of population. That's where the U.S. is really bad.
Well,
much worse than South Korea, Germany, etc.
You can't do that.
Why can't I do that?
You have to go by where, look.
Ed, you talked about ways we can be better prepared for the next pandemic. But what does this clip tell us about President Trump's understanding of this pandemic?
I think it tells me that maybe we should try and elect a president who can read a graph. I'm struggling to work out what to say here. It is a problem when you have someone in charge of a national response who lacks the knowledge and wisdom to know what to do, but more importantly, lacks the humility to tap into people who do know what to do, of which there are many. Trump is surrounded by them, not just people like Tony Fauci, but the entirety of the CDC, who he has sidelined. So many experts in pandemic preparedness, like all the people I've interviewed in my pieces. Why isn't the president listening to them? And it's that lack of humility, that egotism, that lack of the metacognitive ability to know what you don't know that is costing us so badly. Trump thinks he knows everything, and he knows very little. And that the gulf between those two things accounts for a lot of what we're seeing in terms of the federal neglect in the pandemic.
We're discussing the racial disparities that have been made apparent by President Trump's response to the coronavirus pandemic. My guests are Ed Young of The Atlantic and author and scholar Ibram Kendi. And we're hearing from you. Mia wrote on our Facebook page, as an independent, I've really come around to Medicare for All in the past 5 years or so. A healthy population makes virtually everything easier. We also heard from Martin, who says, I firmly believe that Trump is not a racist. Unless we are useful to him, we are all equally worthless. If he could have won power by appealing to Muslims or Latinos and condemning evangelicals, he wouldn't have thought twice about it. We'll hear more from you and from our guests in a moment. We're discussing two emergencies facing the country today, the COVID-19 pandemic and racial injustice. The September issue of The Atlantic tackles both of these with cover stories written by Atlantic writer Ed Young and author Ibram Kendi. Ibram, I want to circle back to that message we got from Martin saying that he doesn't believe Trump is a racist. It's just about people who are useful to him. How do you respond to that?
So it seems to me that Martin defines racist as someone who just inherently sort of hates someone. And I'm trying to gather how he defines racist, because slaveholders, to make money, if they could have enslaved Native people or white people, they would have done so. In many cases, they did. But that doesn't take away that they primarily enslaved black people. Jim Crow segregationists didn't just ensure that black people remained largely impoverished in the South. You also had white people who were being disenfranchised, just not as much as black people. And so I think it's a demonstration that he doesn't necessarily understand the history of racism, that oftentimes people of color are the primary victims of racism, but other people's are the collateral damage.
You compare America's denial of racism with your own very personal denial. You were battling cancer and you didn't want to face it. Tell us about that experience.
Sure. So I was, in my mid-30s, and I was having some symptoms for colon cancer. I just believed that it was nothing. I didn't go to the doctor. I was eventually compelled by my wife to go to the doctor, had a colonoscopy. She found a tumor. And then I just believed, okay, this is a... So my denial then went from I'm not really sick to now, okay, I probably have maybe stage one or stage two cancer. It can't be that serious. And then ultimately, I was told that I had stage four colon cancer. And so I was basically given a choice, continue to deny and guarantee death, or accept and recognize and essentially open the door to my life. And I think America really has those two choices as well, as I argue in my piece.
In the piece you write, I was 35 and I exercised regularly, didn't smoke, rarely drank, and had no family history. I was the vegan, for goodness sake. I wonder how you equate the story that you wrote about yourself and your inability to accept that you were ill with the story that we've written about America.
I mean, it's the same story. In America, we say it's the greatest country on earth. It was founded on freedom and equality. Jefferson wrote, all men are created equal. We've had a black president. We've eliminated slavery. We've eliminated a form of Jim Crow. So we're not racist. There's black people who and Asian and Native and Latinx people who are in positions of power or in the spotlight. So look at all these great things that we've done. There's no way we can be racist. And I think it's the same story. Just as you have individuals who say, I can't be racist, I'm a Democrat. I can't be racist, I'm a Northerner. I can't be racist, I have a black spouse. And on, figuring out ways to really deny the reality that Trump has shown many Americans.
Ed, we got this message from Michael who says, the U.S. is unique. 50 independent states make health decisions. The old are warehoused by their children as the children wait for their deaths. Whoever acted as president would face these realities. At the same time, you say this pandemic has taught us a lot about the racial disparities in our health system. What have you uncovered?
You know, black and brown people have been infected by this virus at disproportionate rates, been killed by this virus at disproportionate rates. And all of that is entirely predictable based on the long history of racism in this country that Ibram has talked about, the deliberate push of healthcare and access to healthcare away from black communities, dating back from after the Civil War and the end of slavery to through the Jim Crow era and right till now, to the opposition of the Affordable Care Act. Black people suffer from poorer health and poorer access to health. And even now, in the middle of the pandemic, people blame. Ibram's written a great piece at The Atlantic about how black people are blamed for disproportionately falling sick with COVID, as if their personal individual choices have led to things like a higher rate of chronic disease that made them more vulnerable, as if that was an answer in itself, without then also asking, well, why do they have higher rates of chronic disease? Could it be because of that long legacy of discrimination, of pushing healthcare away from them, of impoverishing black communities? Why are we not asking that question? I think that point stands alone. I would also address the other thing that that was raised in that question about how any president would have faced these challenges because the U.S. is unique and is a conglomeration of 50 states. True. Yes, that would always have been a challenge. But it's a challenge that can be addressed if the president chooses to address it. The federal government has the power to coordinate the states and to, at the very least, ensure that things like supplies, like tests, are distributed in a fair and efficient fashion. That is not what has happened here. Federalism isn't the idea behind federalism isn't that the federal government is powerless and the states have do everything. It's that the whole system has to work together, top and bottom, working together to control things. And if the top abdicates its responsibility, then the bottom is in chaos. And that is what has happened here.
Well, we asked our listeners to tell us one structural change they would like to see that would help us move forward as a nation. And here's what some of you had to say.
Hi, this is Christine. I'm a law student in D.C., and one systemic change I'd like to see is the restoration of voting rights for convicted felons in all 50 states.
My name is Matthew. I'm calling from Chicago, Illinois. Justice reform. It all comes down to justice reform. What equality is there if our justice system is so broken and unwilling to look at itself and re-examine the past and correct moving into the future?
My name is Brandon from Chicago, Illinois. One thing that could help racism now is to legalize marijuana federally and then to basically forgive any sentences that are currently in prison. And then on the back end of that, we need to get rid of job applications that ask if you have a criminal history, things like that, so that the people that are coming out can start to raise themselves up.
Hello, my name is Patrick. I'm calling you from Houston, Texas. I mean, I don't think the system is ever going to change because it's like telling the white majority that, hey, I want you guys to volunteer and put yourself in a less favorable position. We've just been talking and talking and talking. Nothing else is going to happen.
A couple of other suggestions from our Facebook page. Chris says, one apolitical structural change that might provide an equality of opportunity is regarding public education. If states took all of the property taxes and other streams of revenue for public education and allocated resources to schools on a per capita basis, schools would have reduced inequality. And Richard says, one important structural change would be for journalists and educators to be less afraid of calling a lie a lie. Public radio often does a fairly good job of explaining why the latest thing Trump said is a lie, but they still seem hesitant about it and use words like he misspoke or based on no evidence. Ibram, as you hear that feedback from folks who are hearing this conversation, what do you think of those suggestions?
I agree. I mean, I think when we're thinking about structural change, we should be thinking about how do we sort of eliminate a problem? How do we eliminate an inequity? How do we eliminate an inequality? What are the policies that can do so? Or what can drastically reduce the number of let's say, Black people who are disenfranchised or who are in prison? And some of those policies are certainly answers to those questions.
And another aspect of the pandemic that we were unprepared for is what you call infodemics. Explain what that is.
So that is the widespread of misinformation, so false claims about the pandemic. They have run rife. Again, this was a predictable thing. We saw similar waves of misinformation happen during the Ebola outbreak of 2014. And we've seen them in past epidemics. Now, they cascade very quickly because of things like social media channels, which we know, again, predictable. We know are very good at spreading misinformation faster than actual information because they are run by amoral algorithms that prioritize content that keeps users engaged, even if that content is polarizing, extreme, or false. We've seen that here. So many conspiracy theories, so many lies about COVID-19 have spread over the last several months. Typically faster and more widely than genuine, careful information. Now, you can spot the rise of some of these things happening. There are researchers who work in this area who are doing just that, and they would argue that there needs to be more effort spent on looking for these problems as they arise and trying to cut them off as early as possible, rather than just always playing this game of reactive debunking, which we know doesn't really work. This is the attitude we have for diseases. There are surveillance networks to spot the rise of emerging pathogens. Didn't really work so well this time, but they do a reasonable job for things like flu. We need that kind of network for false information as well as for actual pathogens.
What role has the quick spread of misinformation played in our handling of this pandemic?
I think it's led to a lot of confusion about basic public health measures like wearing a mask, social distancing. They've led to a lot of problems with how people think about treatment. So the ongoing debate about whether hydroxychloroquine works as a treatment for COVID-19 has been fueled by rapidly spreading misinformation by Trump, by his allies, repeatedly promoting this as a miracle drug. And I think it's just led to confusion. And in a horribly cyclical way, people are already fearful and anxious. They're trapped in this vortex of fear and anxiety. The misinformation feeds that, it heightens it, and it means that people then search for more information, which means they spend more time on the same social media channels that are serving them misinformation in the first place. And so the vortex starts spinning faster. This is a big problem. It's something that we really need to be more proactive about addressing. And again, it is a problem that people have been discussing for a long time, for years now, before this pandemic, and has come to fruition over the last several months.
Ibram, we spent most of this conversation talking about President Trump, but I want to talk about the presumptive Democratic presidential nominee, Joe Biden. What do you think of how he's been confronting race through his campaign?
Well, I think he's certainly, I think the issue is whether he is going to respond to those particularly young Black and even Latinx voters who are demanding structural, systemic, progressive change. And they're looking for that certainly in his presidency, and they're certainly looking for that within the Democratic Party in general. And so, as you know, there's this, the issues between these progressive and moderate Democrats. And so what I'm hoping for Joe Biden is that he recognizes that he needs to attract and persuade these young Black and Latinx, largely progressive voters to voting for him, just as he's seeking to persuade white swing voters who may be trying to decide between Trump and Biden, that both are swing voters, particularly because these young Black and Latinx voters are more likely than any other group of voters to swing between Democrat and not voting at all. And so they're swing voters. And so that's what I've been looking to see, whether his campaign is going to treat them as swing voters and respond to them and create policy and policy proposals for them in the way that they may for white swing voters.
How important do you think his vice presidential pick is?
I think it's important, particularly for those voters. I think that it's really the first decision, important decision of his presumed presidency if he was to win. And so I think that's why people are studying it. I think without question, Black women in particular have long, as many people have stated, been the backbone of the Democratic Party. We're certainly critical in his nomination, particularly Southern Black women who are older. And so I think it's critically important for him, like any other politician, to respond to those who are most likely to put him in office.
That's Dr. Ibram Kendi. He's director of the Boston University Center for Anti-Racist Research. He wrote one of the cover stories for The Atlantic's September issue. It's called The End of Denial, and his new book, Anti-Racist Baby, is available now. Ibram, thanks for your time.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And also with us, Ed Young, a science writer at The Atlantic. He's written the other cover story for the September issue of The Atlantic called Anatomy of an American Failure. Ed, thank you.
Thank you.
And a reminder to subscribe to the 1A podcast. It's where you'll find our best guests and stories every day. You can listen whenever you'd like and get it wherever you find your podcasts. Today's producers were Amanda Williams and Sharla Freeland. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks for listening, and let's talk again tomorrow. This is 1A.